Thank you so much for being here. Cecil Williams, photographer, author, best known for his photography documenting the civil rights movement in South Carolina, beginning in the 50s, founders of the Cecil Williams Civil Rights Museum here in Orangeburg. A very special thanks to SCSU President James Clark, Roland Haynes Jr., who runs this auditorium, Ken Davis, Curtis Bradley, and all the other Bulldog staffers who made the broadcast from the MLK Auditorium possible. Special thanks here to our team, to John Hamilton, Dennis Moynihan, Carla Wills, and Libby Rainey. I am Amy Goodman. We'll be broadcasting tonight from 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Check it out at democracynow.org, the first ever forum on environmental justice. I am Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Cliff Bells will be hosting a very special WHFR jazz benefit on Sunday, November 17th. Please join us for an evening of jazz improvisation starring Dave Hurley and the Outer Nebula Trio, featuring Raphael Staton, Bear Trap, Michael Malice's Exploration Ensemble, Planetary Citizenship, featuring O'Donnell, Spangler, Bergman, Wallace, and CUNY. Doors open at 7 o'clock, all ages welcome. Minors must be accompanied by an adult. All proceeds from a $10 donation entry fee go directly to WHFR. We hope to see you at Cliff Bell's on Sunday, November 17th for WHFR's Jazz Benefit. Please visit WHFR.fm for more information.
Please join WHFR.FM 89.3 for blues music on Highway 61, Friday, 2 till 4 p.m. Each week, DJ Kitty Love brings the best in new blues releases in Detroit blues to Henry Ford College Radio, WHFR. Highway
61. Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Good afternoon. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw. Thank you for being with us this Friday afternoon. It is always a pleasure to have you listening to what we have to talk about, which involves things going on here on the Henry Ford College campus and also in the community. So let's just jump right into it, right?
I like that. And I'll tell you, Alan, hello and welcome to our listeners. Some of my favorite topics discussed today: food, books, and art. It doesn't get much better than that as far as I'm concerned, although I'll throw a hammock in there and I'm good to go.
That's like about 90% of my life and probably about 90% of your life too, right?
Well, yeah. In on my perfect island it is, right?
Yeah, right.
But
exactly.
We know how that is.
Yeah, right.
But we are excited to share some events upcoming here on our campus at Henry Ford College, some things going on with the Dearborn Public Library, and there is a big event coming up on our campus and one that is most, I think, decidedly in good taste. And that involves the very exciting chef's dinner that takes place here at the 5101 restaurant. And it is an annual event, and it is involving a variety of amazing courses. And this one is, I think, called Courses something 119 or so. We'll get our chef de cuisine in there. I don't have my glasses on, so I'm not seeing as well these numbers, I'm afraid. But we are excited to kick off our show today with stranger to our airwaves, chef de cuisine of the 5101, Joseph Cosenza. Hello, chef. How are you? Welcome back.
Great. Thank you for having me again. I think it's XIX, and my Roman numerals are terrible, so I don't know if that's
XIX.
16 or 14. It's somewhere around
XIX, that's
19.
Oh, look at that.
We'll go
19.
With that.
Holy smokes, we're getting old. Yeah, Saturday, 6 p.m. is cocktail hour, and dinner starts at 7. $55 a seat, and all the money goes to culinary arts scholarships for our students. We are featuring some really interesting dishes this year. We're doing a modern take on a classic dish called pot au feu, and I know everybody who speaks French is going to rip me apart for saying it wrong, but I cook it right, so that's all that matters.
So we've offended the Romans and we've offended the French at this point.
If I could keep going, it would be great. And so we're doing a really nice modern take on that. We're going to do a really nice steamed cod dish with some bok choy and throw some Asian flavors in there. a celery root soup, which is one of my favorite vegetables, and we're starting off with a grilled maitake mushroom salad. So lots of interesting flavor profiles, lots of great technique behind it, and it's really an opportunity for the chefs to kind of flex their muscles a little bit and show off for the students a little. So it'll be a lot of fun. We're very excited.
Let's parse this out. What's more important, the scholarships or the food? And, you know, at 1 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, the food seems pretty important.
Pretty important.
But,
yeah.
But let's sort of go through when you say that this, you know, supports scholarships for the program. What does that mean?
So what that means is we take just about 75% of the funds that of the ticket price, and we put it into our scholarship fund so that our students can apply for and receive help in for tuition, books, uniforms, knives, whatever it might be.
So in addition to like their tuition to sign up for classes, there are, you know, you got to look
good. There's extra
stuff.
They have to buy a uniform and they have to wear it every day. They have
thermometer if you're going to check the temperature of the meat, all that stuff.
That's required.
Right?
So they also we ask them to buy a knife kit as well, and that, you know, we sell through the bookstore, and scholarship money or, you know, student loans and things like that. That all goes towards paying for all this stuff so that they can, you know, become a line cook and then eventually become a chef. And so, you know, things get expensive. You know, I know that there's this big student loan issue out there hanging over everybody's heads. And we try to make sure that we can help our students in every way, you know, whether it's $100, you know, or $3,000. We're trying to make sure that we give all of our students the opportunity to get their education and that financing is not the barrier to it.
So how long have you been the chef de cuisine here?
I've been here full-time since 2012, and it's been a lot of fun. It's been interesting. Last fall, we changed the style of the menu, which isn't necessarily accurate. We still serve chicken and steaks and fresh pastas and great seafood dishes.
And this goes on week in and week out throughout the course of the school year.
Correct. Right. So we're open 12 weeks of the semester from the middle of September, and we will go until, I believe, the week of the 4th of December. And so right now we're featuring these kind of late mid-fall flavors. You know, we see a little bit of squash. We still have some carrots. We still have some cauliflower on the menu. Next week we're going to roll into what we're considering an early winter menu. So we will see a lot more squash. We'll see a lot of root vegetables. We're going to start to cook risottos and have more braised meats on the menu. We'll do a braised short rib. We're going to have a braised lamb ragu with toasted gnocchi, which seems to be a huge favorite. I've had a bunch of students asking if we could do that dish again, and I kind of bowed to the public and said, sure, go ahead. So we always try to feature ingredients that are local to Michigan. We will go down to Ohio and Indiana. We'll even get some things from Windsor. But we try to stay within a 5-hour from Dearborn radius and make sure that we're getting the most seasonal, the highest quality, the best produce and best meats that we can.
Sounds like what you're really trying to do in the process of not only assisting students with financial challenges, but on the educational side, giving students some tools to really set them apart from other people wanting to work in this industry. I don't know, you know, I know a few other area schools, a few other area school restaurants, but this is pretty hardcore, and it had to have been a purposeful decision to give your students a bit of a leg up.
It was a very purposeful decision. We have had the great opportunity to work with a couple of local chefs over the last 5 years, doing an event for Eastern Market every fall. And in doing that and being able to look and see how they cook, what types of foods they're serving in their restaurants, we made a conscious decision 3 years ago to say, you know what, if we're going to prepare our students properly to work with these chefs, then we have to show them the basics of cooking this way.
and Chef Cosenza. It looks like you're doing just that. We are excited to be talking about the scholarship dinner, an opportunity for people to learn about this amazing restaurant, if I can't imagine they don't already, as members of the community, but also, and more importantly, an opportunity to support our students. Specific details one more time. The event does take place tomorrow. Time frame, and if at this last minute there is availability for people to get seated, how should they go ahead and find that out?
So if there is availability, and I believe there should still be some seats available. We're selling tickets through our foundation website at giving.hfcc.edu/hospitality-scholarship-dinner. Dinner starts at 7, but we're going to have a cocktail hour at 6 p.m. And at the end of the dinner, during dessert, we will have a raffle of Michigan products to give away to all of our most of our guests.
How nice. All those little extra details make it very special.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. We tried it last semester with the little raffle at the end, and it really kind of livened things up, and everybody had a great time, and people were cheering and hooting and hollering, and it was great.
Great. And to clarify, this is going to be food prepared by and served by our students.
Correct.
Our student staff, yes?
That's correct.
Excellent. Well, we can't wait to experience it. Thank you for your time. Continued success. We would love to have you back when we have a bit more time in January to talk about the new semester and the new season, okay?
Sounds great. Thanks again.
All right. Thank you so much. We've got more on the way. This is the WHFR Journal. Please stay with us.
Attention Henry Ford students. The college's winter 2020 semester is fast approaching. Here are some important dates to remember. October 14th, winter 2020 schedule becomes available in the HFC self-service. October 28th, priority registration begins. October 14th, open registration for all students begins. December 23rd, HFC closes for end-of-the-year holidays. January 13th, classes begin. And January 19th is the last day of late registration. Please visit hfcc.edu for more information.
Driving means
freedom,
exploration,
fun,
pride,
flexibility,
protection,
friendship,
escape, independence.
Distracted driving means
danger,
recklessness,
irresponsible,
chaos,
police,
devastation,
injury,
tears, death.
Safe driving means staying alert and staying alive.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, Noise, and the Ad Council.
Man, all this normal radio music is lame. That's why you gotta check out the Synth Warehouse on WHFR, Tuesdays from 10 to midnight. We play house, techno, city pop, lo-fi, and so much more. The Synth Warehouse, Tuesdays at 10 p.m. on the only station making waves, WHFR.FM.
We are back. This is the WHFR Journal, and thank you for staying with us. We are looking at landscapes through Michigan eyes. Don't we do that every day? Because we are Michiganders, and we're always seeing the landscape around us, but we're talking a little more specifically than that. We're talking about an exhibition of contemporary landscape paintings, also drawings and photography, all done by Michigan artists. It's a great opportunity to experience Michigan through a different set of eyes and many very capable artists' sets of eyes. And it's the exhibition going on at the Sisson Gallery right here at our beautiful campus. Here to tell more about the details of this particular event is our own Steve Glazer. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you. Good to see you.
Tell us a little bit about Landscapes Through Michigan Eyes.
Okay. This is an exhibition that Donald Cronkite, who is an alum of HFC and had an exhibition in the Sisson Gallery last year, he and I put it together. It was, I think, Donald's idea initially, and I looked at his roster and said, it's like, let's be a little bit more inclusive. And that sparred us to include a number of, to be more, I'm trying to think of how to say it, gender equal.
Okay.
As far as who was represented. And it's quite, I think, an astonishing exhibition. It has a variety of different ideas of looking at landscape, from a very traditional, very formal, that almost dates back to Renaissance, other than the Renaissance painters always had figures in them, but you could look at Giorgione's landscapes with figures and imagine them very easily without figures. So if you could do that. Two, you know, very contemporary approaches, almost fantastic landscapes, or in the work of one artist, Emily Jane Woods, who sets her easel up someplace in Hamtramck, which is where she lives, and just paints what's in front of her.
So when we say, you know, painting, drawing, and photography, what is sort of the balance between those three mediums?
It is mostly painting.
Okay.
There is one photographer, the late Bill Jackson, died actually a year ago this month, passed away, and though his wife, Megan, whose work is more drawing and mixed media, was kind enough to include his work within, her work is included, and she's very honored to have both their works, because it's like, yeah, to have a school gallery that has artists who, you know, regularly show and sell their work in New York galleries. Mm-hmm. It's like, yes, so whenever Megan Jackson is willing to be in shows at HFC, I think this is the third time. And, you know, to have her husband, I think it's the second or third time he's had work, even though he's no longer with us. It's like the idea of his work lives on.
That's very cool.
I love this concept of landscapes through Michigan eyes. And I guess probably the natural question is, how do we define Michigan eyes? Because this is a big and broad state. There are a lot of landscapes that could be seen by eyes in the state of Michigan. What do we mean when we say Michigan eyes?
That's a good point. Most of the artists are Metro Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Lewis, I believe, is Saginaw. There, he's not someone that I knew before this.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a few that that I picked out, and some that Donald Cronkite picked out. Bill Jackson, Megan Jackson, Lucille Nawara, and Jim Nawara were my picks. And Jim, Professor Emeritus from Wayne State University. Lucille has taught at Wayne, taught at CCS, and I found out when she brought work for the exhibition, taught at Henry Ford in the late 80s for a while as an adjunct painting teacher. And, yes, most of them are Metro Detroit area. Most of the landscapes are related to Michigan. Not all. I think two of Lucille Nawara's were done on site in Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
One or two of them. I'm not sure where Bill's photographs are taken. And, you know, his photographs are strange for most people that look at a photograph and want to see, oh, this is a scene from such and such a place that I recognize, where Bill Jackson has, you know, Tolstoy's War and Peace as enacted by a field of cornstalks. And it's like, but if you look at it, if you look closely, it's cornstalks. But if you stand back and look at it, it's a large photograph. Looks like it could be, you know, a Civil War enactment.
Wow. Well, you're certainly piquing our interest. And when we talk about being able to see some of the most interesting and contemporary pieces of mixed media, this is a one-stop shop, no doubt about it. When can we go? I know it's been around on campus for a couple of weeks.
It's been on campus for a couple of weeks.
How much longer?
It's on until the Wednesday prior to Thanksgiving. I think that's the 27th. It's open Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. till 4:30. I think we have a gallery attendant who stays later on both Tuesdays and Thursdays, but we didn't have that in place when I set up the card. Later, I think she's there till 7 or 8. And I was there this past Saturday, and we had a couple of visitors, but that's all. So I try to keep each one Saturday during each exhibition.
Nice.
Open.
If somebody is interested in sort of scheduling a tour or wants to bring a group over or whatever the case, how can they find more information?
Contact me. Email or phone. Email is sglazer@hfcc.edu. Phone number 313-845-6485. If I'm not in my office, which I'm often not because I teach full-time, run the gallery, faculty chair, quite busy at this part of the semester, leave a message. I'll try to get back as soon as I can.
Well, we're very excited about this. I've been in. I've seen it. I get to walk by it every day. It is frankly inspiring, so we encourage our listeners.
I was going to say, one question I have.
Sure.
And certainly, when we say landscapes through Michigan eyes, we have the beauty of having, like, a full four seasons of what landscapes look like. And
could be the same landscape in case you hadn't noticed.
It's sort of starting to change into something else. You know, how is that represented in what we see?
Well, most of the landscapes are, done during probably warm weather months as far as Michigan is concerned. But the types of landscapes is, it's everyone has a different type of, view that they have put forth. One person, calls himself garbage painters because it's like, she paints, it's like there's a piece that's basically a Wrigley's gum package laying, in grass by a sidewalk. So it's like Wrigley's dust bunnies, but it's like that's, the idea is that when you walk by these things, you don't think of that they could be beauty. And if you say, well, how could garbage be beauty? It's the design of how they fell and in amongst their surroundings. And then Bill Jackson's photograph that's on the card, that it's like, it's titled Ballet, because if you look at it and don't look at it as, just grass, it looks almost like a dance performance. Which is the top left of the card.
It's sort of like seeing the bigger picture beyond the picture. Yeah. Oh, very good. We thank you for your contribution to this gallery and to the artistic culture here on our campus. And know these are open to the very general public.
Yes, they are.
And free of charge. So great opportunity to expand your horizons.
Yeah, it's something to do. And the exhibition got a really nice write-up in Detroit Art Review. Nice. First time since I've been gallery director, so 15 years.
Congratulations.
We've gotten that, that I know of. So real happy with that. But some of the more, the review hit the people that are well-known around Detroit, and so some of the more obscure did not, and they're just as valid.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Well, we thank you for your time, and next time we have you in, we'll spend more time talking about your program and so on. But
no problem.
Thanks again, Steve.
Yeah.
All right.
There's more on the way. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw. Thanks for being with us today for the WHFR Journal.
Henry Ford College's Mirror News is looking for new writers. The newspaper is student-run and a great opportunity for budding journalists to gain experience. The Mirror News covers a variety of topics such as politics, new restaurants, art exhibits, local events, and recent films. If you would like to share your talents, email Dr. Kim at pkim@hfcc.edu or the editor at editor@hfcc.edu. See yourself in the Mirror News.
Well, it's Sunday. Let's see. Morning paper? Check. Coffee perking? Check. Wait. Where's my jazz? Well, I got you, my friend. Hi, I'm Terrence. Your place for good jazz is on 89.3 FM from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. for the Play-It-By-Ear Jazz Show. We're making waves from Henry Ford College. Complete your Sunday trifecta with me. The Play-It-By-Ear Show, Sundays from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. right here on 89.3 WHFR.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw, and it's so great to be with you this Friday afternoon. We've got a lot of things to talk about, and we've got this wonderful art exhibition going on here at the Henry Ford campus, but, you know, Susan, I gotta ask you, have you ever, you moved recently, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you find any, like, library books that you never returned or anything
boy.
Like that? And yeah, it's okay. No, it's fine. It's just between you and I.
I'm pleading the fifth.
Oh, okay.
I'll tell you what I do find, Alan, would be a book that came from a library that maybe I purchased at a book fair or something, and I open it and I freak out because it's got the stamp on it, and it's like, oh my gosh, did I forget to? Da-da-da. And then I realize, oh no, I bought that at a such and such. But but there are people out there, and I'm not even going to throw the question back at you because I think I know what the answer would be. But there are people out there that are dealing with this little tiny issue, and thankfully we have a reprieve in sight. So we are joined by telephone at this time with the department technician in the circulation department at the Dearborn Public Library, and her name is Joy Hickman. And it is a pleasure to have Joy talk to us about this very exciting Food for Finds program. Joy, you're with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. Tell us about this. I know this isn't the first time this program's gone on, and just give us some detail on what this is all about.
Okay, so we've been doing this for a few years now. So Dearborn Public Library, we're offering a Foods for Find program. It runs November 12th through the 27th, and all the donated items will be given to the Dearborn firefighters for distribution to needy families through the Burn Dry Food Cupboard. So library patrons, they can donate non-perishable, non-expired food items and receive a $1 reduction in their overdue library fines for every item that they donate. So they can bring the canned goods to the Bryant Branch Library, that's on Michigan and Mason, or the Esper Branch Library on Warren and Oakman, and they'll be accepting the food, and then they'll reduce the library fines on the patron's record. And there's no limit to the how many cans are donated, but just know that it must be non-perishable, non-expired, and larger than a single serving size. So this is something like pancake mix, instant potatoes, canned juice, canned fruits and vegetables, macaroni and cheese, and anything of that sort. So, and something else that we're doing new this year, we're offering those patrons that don't have a Dearborn Library card, they can come in and every can that they donate, they can get a free internet day pass to use the computers. But just remember that the time that they donate, that's the same time that they must use the computers. So that's pretty much a rundown of the program. But if they need any more information, you can go to the website, dearbornlibrary.org, or contact us at 313-943-2325.
These are brilliant ideas, aren't they, Alan? I mean, getting
Absolutely.
A day pass
yes.
when you're not even a library member to by donating, something to a wonderful cause, and being able to sort of have some fun and surf the net or do some homework or whatever in the process, and also the idea of getting your fines reduced. Now, you'd said, let me make sure that we're clear on this, Joy. If somebody brings in five, you know, canned goods, for example, is that like $5 off their what they owe?
Yep, $5 off their overdue fines. Yep,
and we hope they don't have that many dollars. But
well,
yeah,
that begs the question. Yeah. what kind of fines have you seen, Joy? That people are like literally, I have two grocery bags full, and now my $50 fee is waived or something. How high does it get?
It gets pretty high, but we've seen that. So,
wow.
You know, people make mistakes. They forget that they have things checked out, and you know. Next thing you know, the fines rack up, but hey, this is the perfect time. Bring the canned goods in, and you get all those late fines reduced and waived.
So when you talk about people who can bring in things and also have access to things like internet or, you know, library facilities, how often does that happen where people, you know, may not have that at home, have access to the internet or things like that?
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of people. We get people on the daily. Plenty of people come in, and they don't live in Dearborn, and they try to use the computer, so they have to pay for an internet pass. But, again, if they come in with that canned good, they get on the internet just in switch of that, you know, day pass.
So even here in 2019, there is that idea of a digital divide that libraries can help you know, for people, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We offer everything, almost everything. I'm not going to say everything, but we
right,
do offer
yeah.
a lot to people, you know, including internet services, yep.
So you mentioned the Esper Library, Esper Branch, and also the Bryant Branch. What about the Centennial Branch, which I know has been undergoing, you know, some rebuilding and construction?
Yep, they're still closed, but you can go to Esper and Bryant. They're still open.
Any idea of when that one's going to be open, or?
No, not yet. I'm
okay.
not sure.
All right. Very good.
Well, we are excited that this opportunity exists. I am sure those that are on the receiving end of the much-needed support, food support, are appreciative as well. Have you been with this process before, Joy? Have you seen some of the results the past, you know, year, a couple of years?
Oh, yeah.
And you know, how big does this get?
Oh, man, we sent off 30, 40 boxes full of canned goods to the firefighters. I mean, it gets really, we get a really good feedback off of it, and it's great.
Wow. Well, that's good to hear.
Well, what from what you know, what can you tell us about the, you know, the burn dry food cupboard and how that gets distributed to families in the area?
I'm not exactly sure the details, but I know that the firefighters, they come get the food from us, and then they do their thing on their end.
Well, that sounds like another interview, Susan.
I like it. Well, Joy, we appreciate your time today, and we wish great success to this program. One more time, could you give us the details on the dates upon which people can take advantage
of
this?
And what types of items will be acceptable?
Okay, so the items are canned juice, vegetables, canned fruit, rice, pasta, macaroni and cheese, instant potatoes, pancake mix, soup, anything like that, as long as it's not expired, non-perishable, and larger than a single serving size. And the program runs from November 12th through November 27th, and you can call us for more information at 313-943-2325, or just go on our website at DearbornLibrary.org.
Easy enough. We thank you for your time, Joy, and continued success with this program and all the wonderful things that our public library is doing in our Dearborn community. Thank you.
Well,
and
you
enjoy your weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Okay. Talk to you again. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
It's the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw. Thank you so much for being with us this Friday afternoon.
Avant-garde, transient, cutting edge, different. Come explore the new, the unheard, the forgotten. From Moog synthesizers to unique artists, a unique perspective, a unique musical experience. Space is the place. Experimental music at its finest. Space is the place. Friday evenings from 6 to 8 with your host, Tom Wilson, here on WHFR, Making Waves.
The Hawk's Nest is holding a food drive to help restock the pantry for those in need. Help fight food insecurity on Henry Ford College's campus by making a donation of food or personal hygiene products today. Items can be donated now through November 8th. At the Hawk's Nest in the ASCC Building, L, Room 138, or the Office of Student Activities in the Student Center Building, M, Room 105. For more information or questions, please call 313-317-1756.
Welcome back to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. Glad to have you along with Susan McGraw and I this Friday afternoon. And we're going to continue our program in a way we do every once in a while by listening to some TED Talks, interesting things to think about and perspectives of, you know, the world around us. And since in recognition of the fact that Monday is Veterans Day here in the United States, thought we would spend some time listening to some TED Talks from a veteran's perspective. And we're going to start off with one from a gentleman named Wes Moore, who joined the U.S. Army to pay for college and shares his experience returning home from Afghanistan, and also discusses the single phrase he heard from civilians on repeat and discusses why it's just not sufficient. And then after that, we're going to hear another TED Talk by Melissa Walker. It's about how art can heal veterans. And it talks about how mask making and art therapy works in helping veterans explain and understand and process their experiences. We'll hear them back to back, starting off with Wes Moore and his talk, How to Talk to Veterans About War, here on the WHFR Journal.
I'm excited to be here to speak about vets because I didn't join the Army because I wanted to go to war. I didn't join the Army because I had a lust or a need to go overseas and fight. Frankly, I joined the Army because college is really damn expensive and they were going to help with that. And I joined the Army because it was what I knew. And it was what I knew that I thought I could do well. I didn't come from a military family. I'm not a military brat. No one in my family ever had joined the military at all. And how I first got introduced to the military was when I was 13 years old and I got sent away to military school. Because my mother had been threatening me with this idea of military school ever since I was 8 years old. I had some issues when I was coming up. And my mother would always tell me, she's like, you know, if you don't get this together, I'm going to send you to military school. And I'd look at her and I'd say, Mommy, I'll work harder. And then when I was 9 years old, she started giving me brochures to show me she wasn't playing around. So I'd look at the brochures and I'd be like, okay, Mommy, I can see you're serious and I'll work harder. And then when I was 10 and 11, my behavior just kept on getting worse. I was on academic and disciplinary probation by the time before I even hit single digits or double digits. And I first felt handcuffs on my wrists when I was 11 years old. And so when I was 13 years old, my mother came up to me and she was like, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to send you to military school. And I looked at her and I said, Mommy, I can see you're upset and I'm going to work harder. And she's like, no, you're going next week. And that was how I first got introduced to this whole idea of the military, because she thought this was a good idea. I had to disagree with her wholeheartedly when I first showed up there, because literally in the first 4 days, I had already run away 5 times from this school. They had these big black gates that surrounded the school. And every time they would turn their backs, I would just simply run out of the black gates and take them up on their offer that if we didn't want to be there, we could leave at any time. So I just said, well, if that's the case, then I'd like to leave. And it never worked. And I kept on getting lost. But then eventually, after staying there for a little while, and after the end of that first year at this military school, I realized that I actually was growing up. I realized the things that I enjoyed about this school and the thing that I enjoyed about the structure was something that I never found before. The fact that I finally felt like I was part of something bigger, and part of a team, and it actually mattered to people that I was there. The fact that leadership wasn't just a punchline there, but that it was a real, actually core part of the entire experience. And so when it was time for me to actually finish up high school, I started thinking about what I wanted to do. And just like probably most students, had no idea what that meant or what I wanted to do. And I thought about the people who I respected and admired. I thought about a lot of the people, and particularly about a lot of the men in my life who I looked up to. They all happened to wear the uniform of the United States of America. So for me, the question and the answer really became pretty easy. The question of what I wanted to do was filled in very quickly with saying, I guess I'll be an Army officer. So the Army then went through this process and they trained me up. And when I say I didn't join the Army because I wanted to go to war, the truth is I joined in 1996. There really wasn't a whole lot going on. I didn't ever feel like I was in danger. When I went to my mom, I first joined the Army when I was 17 years old, so I literally needed parental permission to join the Army. So I kind of gave the paperwork to my mom, and she just assumed it was kind of like military school. She's like, well, it was good for him before, so I guess I'll just let him keep doing it. Having no idea that the paperwork that she was signing was actually signing her son up to become an Army officer. And I went through the process, and again, the whole time still just thinking this is great, and maybe I'll serve on a weekend or 2 weeks during the year, do drill. And then a couple years after I signed up, a couple years after my mother signed those papers, the whole world changed. And after 9/11, there was an entirely new context about the occupation that I chose. When I first joined, I never joined to fight. But now that I was in, this is exactly what was now going to happen. And I thought about so much about the soldiers who I eventually had to end up leading. I remember when we first, you know, right after 9/11, 3 weeks after 9/11, I was on a plane heading overseas, but I wasn't heading overseas with the military. I was heading overseas because I got a scholarship to go overseas. I received, you know, the scholarship to go overseas and to go study and live overseas. And I was living in England, and that was interesting. But at the same time, the same people who I was training with, the same soldiers that I went through all my training with and we prepared for war, they were now actually heading over to it. They were now about to find themselves in the middle of places that, fact is, the vast majority of people, the vast majority of us, as we were training, couldn't even point out on a map. I spent a couple years finishing graduate school, and the whole entire time while I'm sitting there in buildings in Oxford that were literally built hundreds of years before the United States was even founded, and I'm sitting there talking to dons about the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, and how that influenced the start of the World War I, where the entire time my heart and my head were on my soldiers, who are now throwing on Kevlars and grabbing their flak vests and figuring out how exactly do I change a round, or how exactly do I clean a machine gun in the darkness. That was the new reality. By the time I finished that up and I rejoined my military unit, and we were getting ready to deploy to Afghanistan, there were soldiers in my unit who were now on their second and third deployments before I even had my first. I remember walking out with my unit for the first time, and when you join the Army and you go through a combat tour, everyone looks at your shoulder, because on your shoulder is your combat patch. And so immediately, as you meet people, you shake their hand, and then your eyes go to their shoulder, because you want to see where did they serve or what unit did they serve with. And I was the only person walking around with a bare shoulder. And it burned every time someone stared at it. But you get a chance to talk to your soldiers. And you ask them, why did they sign up? I signed up because college was expensive. A lot of my soldiers signed up for completely different reasons. They signed up because of a sense of obligation. They signed up because they were angry and they wanted to do something about it. They signed up because their family said this was important. They signed up because they wanted some form of revenge. They signed for a whole collection of different reasons. And now we all found ourselves overseas fighting in these conflicts. And what was amazing to me was that I very naively started hearing this statement that I never fully understood. Because right after 9/11, you start hearing this idea where people come up to you and they say, well, thank you for your service. And I just kind of followed in and started saying the same things to all my soldiers. This is even before I deployed. But I really had no idea what that even meant. I just said it because it sounded right. I said it because it sounded like the right thing to say to people who had served overseas. Thank you for your service. But I had no idea what the context was or what it even meant to the people who heard it. When I first came back from Afghanistan, I thought that if you make it back from conflict, then the dangers were all over. I thought that if you made it back from a conflict zone, that somehow you could kind of wipe the sweat off your brow and say, I'm glad I dodged that one. Without understanding that for so many people, as they come back home, the war keeps going. It keeps playing out in all of our minds. It plays out in all of our memories. It plays out in all of our emotions. Please forgive us if we don't like being in big crowds. Please forgive us when we spend 1 week in a place that has 100% light discipline, because you're not allowed to walk around with white lights, because if anything has a white light, it can be seen from miles away, versus if you use little green or little blue lights, they cannot be seen from far away. So please forgive us if, out of nowhere, we go from having 100% light discipline to then a week later being back in the middle of Times Square, and we have a difficult time adjusting to that. Please forgive us when you transition back to a family who has completely been maneuvering without you. And now when you come back, it's not that easy to fall back into a sense of normality, because the whole normal has changed. I remember when I came back, I wanted to talk to people. I wanted people to ask me about my experiences. I wanted people to come up to me and tell me, what did you do? I wanted people to come up to me and tell me, what was it like? What was the food like? What was the experience like? How are you doing? And the only questions I got from people was, did you shoot anybody? And those were the ones who were even curious enough to say anything. Because sometimes there's this fear and there's this apprehension that if I say anything, I'm afraid I'll offend or I'm afraid I'll trigger something. So the common default is just say nothing. The problem with that is then it feels like your service was not even acknowledged. Like no one even cared. Thank you for your service. And we move on. What I wanted to better understand was what's behind that. And why thank you for your service isn't enough. The fact is we have literally 2.6 million men and women who are veterans of Iraq or Afghanistan who are all amongst us. Sometimes we know who they are, sometimes we don't. But there is that feeling, this shared experience, this shared bond, where we know that that experience in that chapter of our life, while it might be closed, it's still not over. When we think about thank you for your service, and people say, so what does thank you for your service mean to you? Well, thank you for your service means to me, it means acknowledging our stories, asking us who we are, understanding the strength that so many people who we serve with have, and why that service means so much. Thank you for your service means acknowledging the fact that just because we've now come home and we've taken off a uniform does not mean our larger service to this country is somehow over. The fact is there's still a tremendous amount that can be offered and can be given. When I look at people like our friend Taylor Urella, who in Iraq loses his leg, had two big dreams in his life. One was to be a soldier, the other was to be a baseball player. He loses his leg in Iraq. He comes back, and instead of deciding that, now since I've lost my leg, that second dream is over, he decides that he still has that dream of playing baseball, and he starts this group called Vet Sports, which now works with veterans all over the country and uses sports as a way of healing. People like Tammy Duckworth, who's a helicopter pilot, and with a helicopter that she was flying, you need to use both your hands and also your legs to steer, and her helicopter gets hit, and she's trying to steer the chopper, but the chopper's not reacting to her instructions and to her commands. She's trying to land the chopper safely, but the chopper doesn't land safely, and the reason it's not landing safely is because it's not responding to the commands that her legs are giving, because her legs were blown off. She barely survives. Medics come and they save her life. But then as she's doing her recuperation back at home, she realizes that my job's still not done. And now she uses her voice as a congresswoman from Illinois to fight and advocate for a collection of issues to include veterans' issues. We signed up because we love this country we represent. We signed up because we believe in the idea and we believe to the people to our left and to our right. And the only thing we then ask is that thank you for your service needs to be more than just a quote break. That thank you for your service means honestly digging in to the people who've stepped up simply because they were asked to. And what that means for us, not just now, not just during combat operations, but long after the last vehicle has left and after the last shot has been taken. These are the people who I served with. And these are the people who I honor. So thank you for your service.
You are a high-ranking military service member deployed to Afghanistan. You are responsible for the lives of hundreds of men and women and your base is under attack. Incoming mortar rounds are exploding all around you. Struggling to see through the dust and the smoke, you do your best to assist the wounded and then crawl to a nearby bunker. Conscious but dazed by the blasts, you lay on your side and attempt to process what has just happened. As you regain your vision, you see a bloody face staring back at you. The image is terrifying, but you quickly come to understand it's not real. This vision continues to visit you multiple times a day and in your sleep. You choose not to tell anyone for fear of losing your job or being seen as weak. You give the vision a name, Bloody Face and Bunker, and call it BFib for short. You keep BFib locked away in your mind, secretly haunting you for the next 7 years. Now close your eyes. Can you see BFib? If you can, you're beginning to see the face of the invisible wounds of war, commonly known as post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. While I can't say I have post-traumatic stress disorder, I've never been a stranger to it. When I was a little girl, I would visit my grandparents every summer. It was my grandfather who introduced me to the effects of combat on the psyche. While my grandfather was serving as a Marine in the Korean War, a bullet pierced his neck and rendered him unable to cry out. He watched as a corpsman passed him over, declaring him a goner, and then leaving him to die. Years later, after his physical wounds had healed and he'd returned home, he rarely spoke of his experiences in waking life. But at night, I would hear him shouting obscenities from his room down the hall. And during the day, I would announce myself as I entered the room, careful not to startle or agitate him. He lived out the remainder of his days isolated and tight-lipped, never finding a way to express himself, and I didn't yet have the tools to guide him. I wouldn't have a name for my grandfather's condition until I was in my 20s. Seeking a graduate degree in art therapy, I naturally gravitated towards the study of trauma. And while sitting in class learning about post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD for short, my mission to help service members who suffered like my grandfather began to take form. We've had various names for post-traumatic stress throughout the history of war. Homesickness, soldier's heart, shell shock, thousand-yard stare, for instance. And while I was pursuing my degree, a new war was raging, and thanks to modern body armor and military vehicles, service members were surviving blast injuries they wouldn't have before. But the invisible wounds were reaching new levels, and this pushed military doctors and researchers to try and truly understand the effects that traumatic brain injury, or TBI, and PTSD have on the brain. Due to advances in technology and neuroimaging, we now know there's an actual shutdown in the Broca's, or the speech-language area of the brain, after an individual experiences trauma. This physiological change, or speechless terror as it's often called, coupled with mental health stigma, the fear of being judged or misunderstood, possibly even removed from their current duties, has led to the invisible struggles of our servicemen and women. Generation after generation of veterans have chosen not to talk about their experiences and suffer in solitude. I had my work cut out for me when I got my first job as an art therapist at the nation's largest military medical center, Walter Reed. After working for a few years on a locked inpatient psychiatric unit, I eventually transferred to the National Intrepid Center of Excellence, NICO, which leads TBI care for active duty service members. Now, I believed in art therapy, but I was going to have to convince service members, big, tough, strong, manly military men, and some women too, to give art making as a psychotherapeutic intervention a try. The results have been nothing short of spectacular. Vivid, symbolic artwork is being created by our servicemen and women, and every work of art tells a story. We've observed that the process of art therapy bypasses the speech-language issue with the brain. Art making accesses the same sensory areas of the brain that encode trauma. Service members can use the art making to work through their experiences in a non-threatening way. They can then apply words to their physical creations, reintegrating the left and the right hemispheres of the brain. Now, we've seen this can work with all forms of art, drawing, painting, collage. But what seems to have the most impact is mask making. Finally, these invisible wounds don't just have a name. They have a face. And when service members create these masks, it allows them to come to grips, literally, with their trauma. And it's amazing how often that enables them to break through the trauma and start to heal. Remember BFib? That was a real experience for one of my patients. And when he created his mask, he was able to let go of that haunting image. Initially, it was a daunting process for the service member, but eventually he began to think of BFib as the mask, not his internal wound. And he would go to leave each session, he'd hand me the mask and say, "Melissa, take care of him." Eventually, we placed BFib in a box to further contain him. And when the service member went to leave the NICO, he chose to leave BFib behind. A year later, he had only seen BFib twice, and both times BFib was smiling and the service member didn't feel anxious. Now, whenever that service member is haunted by some traumatic memory, he continues to paint. Every time he paints these disturbing images, he sees them less or not at all. Philosophers have told us for thousands of years that the power to create is very closely linked to the power to destroy. Now, science is showing us that the part of the brain that registers a traumatic wound can be the part of the brain where healing happens too. And art therapy is showing us how to make that connection. We asked one of our service members to describe how mask making impacted his treatment. And this is what he had to say.
You sort of just zone out into the mask. You zone out into the drawing. And for me, it just released the block. So I was able to do it. And then when I looked at it after 2 days, I was like, holy crap, here's the picture, here's the key, here's the puzzle. And then from there, it just soared. I mean, from there, my treatment just went, you know, out of sight, because they were like, Kurt, explain this. And for the first time in 23 years, I could actually talk about stuff openly to, like, anybody. I could talk to you about it right now if I wanted to, because it unlocked it. It's just amazing. And it allowed me to put 23 years of PTSD and TBI stuff together in one place that has never happened before. Sorry.
Over the past 5 years, we've had over 1,000 masks made. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? Thank you. I wish I could have shared this process with my grandfather, but I know that he would be thrilled that we are finding ways to help today's and tomorrow's service members heal and finding the resources within them that they can call upon to heal themselves. Thank you.
Melissa Walker and a TED Talk entitled Art Can Heal PTSD's Invisible Wounds. It was given as part of a TED conference in 2015. She helps military service members recover from traumatic brain injury and mental illness, and especially through the medium of art therapy and, as discussed, mask making. Before that, we heard veteran Wes Mort about, and his talk, TED Talk, about how to talk to veterans about war. It was given at a TED Salon in in 2014. His life transformed with the words out of his mouth, his mother's mouth, "I'm sending you to military school." He's the author of the book, The Other Wes Moore, and is a vocal advocate for America's youth, as well as for fellow veterans returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan. You've been listening to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. Thanks so much for being with us this Friday afternoon. Kitty Love comes up next. It's time for a trip down Highway 61 here on WHFR Making Waves.
Life is full of bittersweet transitions. It's difficult to know how these changes will impact us over time. For some people, difficult transitions like retirement, divorce, or loss of a loved one can hit harder than expected and may contribute to feelings of hopelessness or even thoughts of suicide. The risk of suicide is even higher for men over 50 who served our country. Guys like me. That's why support from friends and family makes such a big difference. Every day, your actions could help save a life. Together, we got this. Learn how you can help save a life at VeteransCrisisLine.net.
If you want to change the world, then you have to change yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford College. Henry Ford College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
Listener supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
South of Memphis, Tennessee.